You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Not a bad song if you have to listen to one. Satisfaction. It's a Vietnam song. Hope that's all right, sir. Tom Drowdy.
Oh, yeah. No flashbacks. I thought it was 11:15. I'm glad I was here standing by.
First of all, good morning. Retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Tom Drowdy joins us. Sir, thanks for coming on again. Always enjoy having you on.
Thank you. My pleasure and honor, Matt.
First of all, a quick bio, born and raised. Where were you born and raised?
I'm sorry, a place called Kankakee, Illinois, about 60 miles south of Chicago.
Okay, and joins the Marine Corps by way of the Naval Academy, an infantry officer by trade, what was your last job in the Marine Corps?
I was Director of Public Affairs just before I retired in 1st of January of 93, after 30 and a half years.
All right, 30 and a half years. And then what are you doing now?
Now I'm teaching. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I went to work for USAA for a little over 10 years, and then headed the Marine Corps University Foundation for about 11 years, and now I'm teaching here in Florida at St. Leo University and also the University of South Florida.
University of South Florida, I want to say that's the most veteran-friendly university in the nation.
You're exactly right. Yeah, I was voted number one. And in fact, when that came out, I sent an email to the president, Dr. Genshaft, to let him know of the great honor that they had received. Yeah, I've got a tremendous ROTC unit. In fact, I have a meeting today with the veterans group that they have here as well. So it's a very active community and very military-friendly.
Do you know Marty Steele? I think he sits on the board there.
Sure. Yeah, Marty and I go back many, many years.
How do you know him?
Well, he was the LAV commander when I had the 5th Marines, and we shared Camp Margarita together.
You know what? I told you I wasn't sure where our paths had crossed. You followed Marty Brantner.
Right.
Who just passed away.
Yeah.
As the regimental commander there, and I was a member of 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and then came home, and they were not retaining any reserve officers in their MOSs. So I thought, well, if I could maybe have a little bit of LAV experience at the time, maybe I could stay in my MOS. And went over, and I hadn't really served for very many good officers in my life. Chip Gregson was my battalion commander, but as a second lieutenant, I didn't really get to spend too much time with him. And so when I went to 1st LAV Battalion, Marty Steele, I walked in, and I introduced myself to the XO, who had no time for me, and his name was Ken Falasco. And then he said, come back at 1300, the CO will see you then. And I said, okay, so at 1300, I pound on the door frame. Sir Lieutenant McNamara reporting to see the battalion commander. He says, come on in here. And he was changing out to PTN. And he sat me down, and for an hour and a half, he told me what light armored reconnaissance would be in the Marine Corps. I had never spent 90 minutes with anybody above the rank of captain in my life. And here this guy is, he's taking me on this journey of what it's going to be. And I was absolutely blown away by him. And he and I have been friends ever since. And he's just a great man. Rose to the rank, I think the only tank officer in the Marine Corps to rise to the rank of lieutenant general. And interesting, great guy, great guy.
I think you're right on all accounts. Yeah, certainly the case. So, yeah, Marty is down here as well. Let's see. General Deegan is in the area also. And a couple of others that have decided to reside in the Tampa area. So it's a good community in all respects.
All right. No, there's a bunch of you guys living down there. That might be the greatest concentration of Marines I know of in retirement is in the Tampa area. There's certainly a lot of you guys.
There are, and we've gotten together from time to time, and always a pleasure to do so. And and a good overall Marine community here as well. So we're truly blessed.
Let me get your thoughts. A couple things. I applaud this one. The Department of Defense not announcing deployments. Good thing, bad thing. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a great thing. Why would we indicate to anyone, especially enemies, either current or potential, what our deployments are? Sizes, capabilities, et cetera. That just to me makes no sense whatsoever. And I think a bonus effect of it, Mac, is that it instills in our Marines this notion of operation security, like a quaint notion these days of social media. But the fact that there are some things that are just not to be shared, not necessarily that they're classified, but it's information that would benefit those who wish us ill, and to just to not put that out there for public consumption. So I'm in great favor of Department of Defense decision. And after the fact, that's fine, all well and good. But this is in no way, shape, or form trying to hide anything from the American public. It's rather operational security that I think is valid and prudent.
No, I absolutely agree with you. Let me get your thoughts on this, and then we'll kind of combine the two together. I don't feel good about, though, I don't understand the end state in Syria. I watched the Senate Armed Service Committee testimony, I believe, of General Vogel, and he talked about we were in Iraq, certainly at the invitation of the Iraq government. The question was, why are we in Syria? He said, it's an extension of the conflict in Iraq. It's a kind of a tough, that's a bit of a stretch when you go to Raqqa, which is almost 250 miles into Syria. Have you seen an articulated end state for Syria, for what are combat operations in Syria, and do you find that at all disturbing?
The end state, as I understand it, Mac, is the overthrow of Bashar Assad as a head of Syria, who's killed, I think, around 400,000 of his people, in addition to displacing another 500,000. So that was stated a while back that he must go, but you recall that the red lines that were drawn and then erased and all of the rhetoric that has gone on, but as far as I know, that's still our stated purpose, but how that is going to be accomplished vis-a-vis the allies that he has, including Iran and various groups, and then it gets confusing as to who's on whose side. But I think this is one of the real problems, and it's so ironic in a course that I'm teaching. We're just getting into the early days of Vietnam, and a tremendous book called Dereliction of Duty, written by now Lieutenant General McMaster. But
one of the most one of the most depressing books you'll ever read in your life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm rereading it, and it's the tears just keep filling my eyes, thinking of decisions that were made in 64 and 65 as I was trying to get the platoon ready to go into combat. And we have leaders who weren't certain what we were supposed to be doing there other than it's okay to lose as long as we do it honorably. Getting back to this situation, this is serious stuff, obviously, and it's beyond me why we can't have a clearly defined mission. What are our objectives and what is the strategy that we plan? Not that we share all of that, but that at least something exists other than, we're just going to continue to send troops to accomplish something that I'm really not certain what it is. So, and I contrast Vietnam dramatically with Desert Storm, because in that situation we had a clear-cut objective, what we were wanted to accomplish, when it would be over, and then when it was over, then we left. I mean, it was, and the American people understood that because it was simply stated, but clearly stated by the president.
Dereliction of duty causes me great consternation because I see, and I think you and I have talked about this, many parallels between that and Iraq. And Desert Storm, I would tell you, is almost like a watershed, and it's almost like the cherry on top for Vietnam era leaders in that I think they spent much of their career trying to keep us out of military situations that the military force wasn't appropriate in. And then Desert Storm really is almost like this beautiful anomaly where we fight in largely in the desert, and not a whole lot of civilians. Everybody's got a uniform on, or just about everybody had a uniform on. And very defined objectives. We go, we whack them, we then turn it over to the Kuwaitis again and the Saudis, and we leave. It is the cleanest of clean, this anomaly. And I would say almost like the crowning glory of Vietnam-era Marine soldiers, sailors, leaders for navigating that. And then it seems like since that watershed event, we've struggled much more to define military objectives, to define what it is to be success, to win in phase four, all the things that you and I have discussed here. So I would tell you that I thought our purpose currently in Syria was the destruction of ISIS. And now I know Senator McCain wants Assad to go, but I don't think the administration does. So I would say, even between you and I think we're both relatively well informed, we don't even see. Obviously, it's not clear.
Yeah, and that statement you just made speaks volumes, Mac. Because if it's not clear to you and me, who try to stay current on these things, it is certainly not clear to 99% of the American people. But even more important, how clear is it to those that were asking to put their lives on the line? I mean, one of the terrible things about Vietnam was the over 58,000 who died. And the question is, for why, for what purpose? And there's a book by Douglas Kennard called The War Managers, and he interviewed returning Army generals from Vietnam and asked them a simple question: what was your mission? And over 90% of them could not give him an answer. So, if you don't know what you're fighting for, what you're dying for, then we have a real, real challenge. And you just described a situation in Syria. Why are we there? And I'm sure it's for good reason. I would just like to know what that reason is. And I think it's more important for those who are there, who are facing the enemy, that they are aware of why they're in that conflict. It just these are such elementary issues of and the course that I teach is designed to why we fight and how we fight U.S. wars. And it's interesting that in some it's been fairly clear, obviously, World War One, World War Two, Korea. But then we get into Vietnam, and then it goes the other way, and then we come back with Desert Storm, just as you've articulated. But this shouldn't be that difficult. You know, we're a nation of great communicators, allegedly. Why can't we communicate what our purpose is of sending our sons and daughters into battle?
It is problematic. And again, I watched that Senate. For those of you who don't tend to do that, I would tell you, I would recommend to you, when the Senate Armed Service holds committee meetings, watch them. Record them, find them on the internet. They have a website, Senate Armed Service Committee. If you search for it on the internet, Google it, you'll find it. But you're hearing it straight from the horse's mouth. You're hearing relatively blunt questions. And yes, there is political grandstanding that goes on. But you're hearing these guys in the most open form, really, they'll ever be involved in. And yeah, reporters may ferret out additional details, but you're hearing these leaders of our nation. In this case, I think it was General Vogel and then General Waldhauser, who's AFRICOM, talking about what's going on and the raid in Yemen and things like that. So I would tell people, watch that stuff. It is so much better than the news, and you're getting it via Far Direct. But I find it disturbing that that was what Vogel said. We're into Syria as an extension of our invitation to into Iraq. And then Senator Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's running mate.
Right, Tim Kaine. Uh-huh.
Who has a son who's a Marine.
Yeah.
He said, wait a minute, this is what we criticize other nations for doing. All right, so if we're going to go into Syria, what is the pretense we're going there? Make sure that the international community understands this, and we've articulated. He said, I don't really understand how we're going in there. You know, I understand the airstrike piece of it, but now we're talking about putting an artillery battery and a couple hundred Marines into Syria to support the operations in Mosul and that ongoing offensive. And so, and I was, you know, I'm sympathetic to that. You know, what are we doing there? So kind of interesting.
When our leaders are unable to answer those basic questions, then you know that there's some issues that ought to be pursued, and that is, how seriously has this been sought out, and what exactly again do we want to accomplish? And overriding is, we put our sons and daughters into harm's way for our national interests. And so, you know, defining those national interests vis-a-vis this commitment can sometimes be challenging, as they should be. This should be something that is well thought out, because we're sending our most precious commodity, putting them in harm's way. So I think we're both saying the same thing. It's a matter of a clear-cut guidance and determination of objectives and what the mission is.
When you look back, I got an email for you. Hey, Mac, listening to General Drowdy talk about Vietnam. I have Ned Seath interview. I don't know if you heard the story of Ned Seath, but he was he's a machine gunner in Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. He's in Vietnam in 1966. In February of 2011, he's awarded the Navy Cross and the Bronze Star with V for actions, I want to say, in July of 1966 during Operation Hastings, I think.
Uh-huh. That'd be about right.
Kilo 3-4 is the anvil against which the hammer is going to strike. The problem is they go into an area that's pretty well prepared defensive position. They get inserted into it, and then they fight. He's a machine gun section leader. During the evening and through the night, he has two He has three machine guns that go down. They don't have a functional. Two of the machine guns are firing single shot, which obviously something happened to the spring. One has been hit by, I want to say, would have been a B-60 rocket, or an RPG. And so he gets all three guns to one spot, and then he makes one good gun out of them. During that process, the order to fix bayonets is given. Now, sir, I know you didn't serve in the Civil War. How often the Marine Corps did you ever hear the command fix bayonets given in a serious tone?
Well, I gave that command in Vietnam.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it was Operation Hot Springs in April of 1966, and we had encountered a hamlet that turned out to be a B.C. headquarters, and I used all the supporting arms available against it, and it was just not budging, and so as the sun was going down, there's only one way to take it, and that was going to be through a bayonet assault. So I gave that command, and it was interesting, the reaction, Mac, just this calm feeling overcame the company of, you know, this is as grisly as it's going to get. We're not going to shoot somebody at 300 yards or drop an artillery mortar round on them. You know, we're going to go in and smash and slash and beat to death or stab another human being. And in a minute or so, somebody's going to die at one end of this rifle or the other. And the assault was a success, but that was a feeling that I'll never forget of giving that command. And then the just this feeling of calm and purpose that overcame the company of okay, this is it. This is what we've been trained for. This is as realistic and as I say, grisly as it will ever get. And of course, the Marines responded. So, yeah, I don't think there are too many times when fixed bayonets was given, but that was one of them.
That's unbelievable, sir. So, what was the tactical situation that you ordered it? What was going on? So you had hammered it with all the supporting arms you could, and you had reduced it, and now you were going to go into it. I'm curious. You're the first person I've ever heard I've spoken with that's ordered that.
Yeah, we had reduced as much as possible, but the enemy is still in force, and my objective was to take it. So did a kind of a, the fact was interesting. An envelopment, but we got into the habit of always enveloping from the right. And as you know, when you establish a pattern, you're setting yourself up for a disaster. So on this occasion, and the terrain supported it, we had supporting fires and then the envelopment from the left and was successful. But that was the way that we seized the hamlet and achieved the objective with the loss of I think we killed about 31, at least that we know of, on that evening.
What did that, I'll finish the story. So, in the process of hearing the command fix bayonets, he continues about his task, which is making three guns one, finally has an operable M60, and then as soon as he gets it up, he begins to engage the enemy. At one point, it sounds much like, you know, John Bazelon at the Tenebrae River.
Yeah.
There's so many bodies in front of him. He has to get out of the prone position, and I think then he goes to the kneeling position, and then ultimately, you know, to the offhand. He's a big guy too, so one of those guys made to be a machine gunner.
yeah.
They totaled. The interview is incredible, in that I think they attribute that he killed over 100 NVA soldiers throughout the course of the night, and his story is just incredible. And when you take that, sir, as you've retired and you juxtapose that over a book like Dereliction of Duty, you see that kind of selflessness and courage. Your Marines as they fix bayonets, right, and going forward into that, and then you read then you read Dereliction of Duty. How do you not do that with, does your stomach sit in a knot? Are you nauseated when you read that? Because it's the most selfless against, dare I say, the most cowardly, but guys who aren't doing their duty, people who aren't living up to the oath they take to the Constitution, and yet you're on the business end of it. What is it like to go through that now?
First of all, a quick story. In the attack on Pleiku about January of 65, McGeorge Bundy was there in Vietnam, so he went over to see it, and it had a profound effect on him because he went to visit the casualties and saw the dead, and it suddenly occurred to him that the numbers of casualties in Vietnam were not like the numbers of traffic fatalities in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, they weren't just pictures in Life magazine.
Yeah, and they weren't, and so he had now seen face to face those who were, carrying out the instructions that he was there very much a part of. Now, it had a profound effect. It didn't really change him, but I've just found it, amazing that for bureaucrats, maybe that's what it takes, is to put a face on the decisions that they are making. But getting back to your question, how do I feel? Well, I'm astounded at the duplicity of the administration. The Vietnam was when we stopped believing our leaders, and I think for good reason, because of duplicity and deception that was so much a part of the information coming from the White House on down. But there's no bitterness because of the experience that I was blessed to have of being with Marines that I consider, my sons at the time, although I was but 25 years old. But, that relationship, that camaraderie, will never be taken away. And it came at a terrible price, I've got to admit. But, I can only hope that the people who were making those decisions thought that they were doing the right thing. Hard to understand how they could have thought that, but
yeah,
all had a job to do. We all had a hand that was dealt us, and all we could do was to play that hand as best we could, which is what we were trying to do with our Marines.
I don't know how you come to that. There seems to be the sole mission for some of those people is political.
Re-election, yeah.
And it's the re-election, and so it's like we can't allow the nation to know what's actually going on in Vietnam. And again, unless McMaster, misrepresented, and I know people have taken issue with some of the things he's written, but by and large, other people have said, that's the Joint Chiefs of Staff were somewhat disenfranchised, in some cases completely disenfranchised, and we're not a part of it. Secretary McNamara, no relation, by the way. He was a whiz kid. He was a smart guy.
Yeah.
He was applying his metrics as the cure-all for everything. That his metrics would win out, and he didn't know anything about what he was doing, and certainly about not making about winning phase four and how to do it. And so the ignorance and the hubris, the arrogance, to me is astounding when you read it, and not listening to guys who and if you didn't like the guys in the Joint Chiefs, then replace them with guys you do like and whose opinions you do value. So it just I don't know. I can't imagine. It makes me sick to read it. I can't imagine, what that feels like for a guy like you.
Well, in a further endorsement of what you said, are the books written by McNamara in retrospect and on reflection, I think were the names. But there's also a great documentary called The Fog of War, and this is based very much on recordings between President Johnson and Secretary McNamara. And in it, there's a confession that, for example, the second attack in the Gulf of Tonkin never happened. Yet that was the basis for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that gave the president a blank check for Vietnam. And so, that whole premise was based upon a story that just wasn't true. And President Johnson was later quoted as saying, "Hell, for all I know, those damn stupid sailors were shooting at whales." Well, a hell of an indictment of our great sailors, but that was kind of a situation of, well, the incident provided what was needed in order to pass the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. By the way, do you know what the vote was on that, Mac, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution?
No, I do not.
No, prepare yourself to be stunned. Two senators voted against it. A guy named Morris from Oregon and Gruening from Alaska. The rest of the Senate voted in favor of it. And in the House of Representatives, it passed unanimously. Can you think of any issue that could ever be brought before Congress today that would ever be passed by the House of Representatives unanimously and by the Senate with only two dissenting votes? Apple pie, motherhood, cure of cancer. I can't think of a single, but that was the overwhelming support that was provided in 1964, the blank check given to the president regarding Vietnam.
Well, I would say this after what I watched relative to the war in Iraq. When the basis of a vote is sticking your finger up in the air and asking the question, how is it polling in the district? And you don't do what you're supposed to do, which might start with reading the classified intelligence assessment. It might start with that. And if you read it, because I think every one of us who watched what Colin Powell took to the UN sat there and said, is that it? Where in God's name is the smoking gun that gets us to war? It sure as hell didn't get aired out in an open session. And so might I go do a little research? Because this doesn't look like a very tight argument to me. And even for a novice to suggest that Al-Qaeda was operating, somehow or other in Iraq with Saddam Hussein's consent was absurd, and they were fundamentally opposed to each other. And so I guess I do understand it. It gets printed in the paper. At that time there was no internet. The way we got information was vastly different. Who would suspect that the Navy and different people along the way helped fabricate that event? I mean, nobody would believe that, would they, sir?
No, but the conflicting reports coming in, from that is, we think this happened, and then there's one phrase where Sink Pack is saying, this happened beyond a doubt, I think. it's simply that there's lots of confusion, but then there's a telling statement in the book about how back in Washington, folks were marshaling the evidence. When I hear the word marshaling the evidence,
yes,
the phrase comes to mind, cooking the books.
Right.
So as you read this, and as I'm relating to my students, and it's tough to not get kind of emotional, the first day in class I brought in an item that I had bought years ago. It was a heavy paper foldout of the Vietnam Wall. Every name, that is on there. And you, of course, it's very, very small, but that was, to me, the start of the class of the effect that Vietnam had and still has on us, not the least of which is the families that were affected by that. And then I asked the students if anybody had seen the wall, and a few of them had, and asked for their impressions. And I thought one of the most accurate one was, you know, sir, the names just go on and on. I said, yeah, they do. And then I asked, do you recall what the surface of the wall is? And a few of them said, well, I think it's black or something. And I said, yeah, it's a black, almost a marble mirror finish. And I said, to me, the significance of the wall is just when I go there and I'm looking at a name on the wall, I'm looking at my face. And the symbolism of what is the difference between being a name on the wall or a face on the wall, you know, a millisecond, you know, a fraction of an inch, all of those things. So that whole visual impact is just so significant. But it again points out how I think we have to continue to look at the Vietnam for the lessons that we should have learned, but in many ways have not learned.
You know, I think it's one of the themes of the program. You know, sir, it's this, it's the lament of, will you do your duty? Will you do your constitutional duty? Will you live up to that oath that you swore? And it just seems, you know, and Mike Flynn is the latest example. And I've had people said, you know, Mac, you're being too hard on him. Which is ironic because I saw, you know, why does Flynn need immunity? He's a lieutenant general in the United States military, you know, recently retired, and now he needs immunity, and he was in office for how long, for God's sake? Why does that guy need immunity? Well, you know, you remember, you know, I had somebody saying, probably quite rightly, well, remember Scooter Libby and what happened to him? Scooter Libby went to jail for perjury. He didn't go to jail for outing or anything. He went to jail for the aftermath. And maybe he took a fall for somebody else. I'm not exactly sure. But so I have kind of this to say about that. When these things happen and you're incapable of doing the right thing, what in the world is going on with our government? It's, you know, to me, sir, it's crazy, you know, sometimes what happens to people in terms of when they go serve. Do they forget? Do their senses leave them that whose work they're actually there doing? Because just so everybody knows, those names on the Vietnam wall, those aren't names. Those are actual human beings that actually lost the only life they will actually ever live. They lost it in Vietnam. And so it's mind-blowing to think that we've lost our way to the extent that you can't compromise and do what's best for the country because you'll just get blown away in your next election.
Yep.
We're going to rewrite the rules of the Senate to confirm a justice who, by all accounts that I've seen, you know, ought to be confirmed. But we can't do that.
Yep.
So I guess, I don't know, sir. To me, it's extremely disillusioning. And maybe, I don't know if I'm just, I'm a half-empty guy these days. But I've watched the way we've mucked up Afghanistan. I've watched the way we've mucked about in Iraq, destabilizing the region and then making it worse. And I scratch my head and I think about where is George Marshall when we need him? And I know guys like, in fact, I just saw the story. You're probably familiar with it. I was not. The story of a naval aviator from the United States Naval Academy, Medal of Honor winner. His last name is Huebner, who crash landed his Corsair at the Chosin Reservoir to rescue his friend, who was the first black naval aviator, a guy named Jesse Brown.
Right.
There's a book out called Devotion, and the Navy just christened a ship in his honor over the course of the last weekend. And, you know, are you kidding me? He crash landed his plane right? At the chosen reservoir. That's not TA-15 or something like that, okay?
Yeah.
That's, he's going to do that, and he's probably going to die to try to save his friend, his Jesse Brown. They couldn't extract from the wreckage, and he died there. And then Huemer was pulled out of there by a helicopter at the chosen reservoir. And but those people still exist. I've seen them. I've seen them. And yet it just seems like the gulf between that sacrifice and Washington is wider than it was during Vietnam. And it's hard for me to even get out of my mouth, but I don't see another conclusion. It doesn't seem like they get it. And even in spite of the results of the last elections, which to me was, hey, we're tired of it. Okay, we want you to go there and do our business, which you seem incapable of. But I don't know. The message doesn't seem to resonate, or at least stick anyway.
Yeah. So. Mac, let me for you and your readers, another piece on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, excuse me, and President Johnson. Piece is written by now deceased Lieutenant General Charles Cooper, and I worked for him and a great leader. But this piece is called "The Day It Became the Longest War," and it relates his visit when he was aide to the Chief of Naval Operations, and the other Joint Chiefs of Staff paid a visit to President Johnson in November of '65, where they spoke up and laid out their feelings and the response and reaction. It's a telling indictment of truth to power. And the fact that sometimes the truth is not good news, but then the test of leaders is to what they do with the truth. So I just offer that to you.
Okay, is that a book, sir? Is it an article?
He wrote a book called "Cheers and Tears."
Okay.
A Marine Story of Combat and Peace and War. But this particular thing is I picked it off the internet. It's called "The Day It Became the Longest War."
And is that in the U.S. Naval Institute? That's what I found.
Yes, it was, published by the Naval Institute. But if you go to History News Network, I went just looking for it, the JCS and LBJ, and came across it. But it's, a very, very telling piece.
Okay, the History News Network. Okay, I found it. And so now how did you know General Cooper?
I worked for him at FMF PAC.
Okay.
And he was the CG there, and I was his inspector for a year and then his G1 for a year.
And he wrote this in 2007, it looks like. Or was it earlier?
It shows under 1-2007. But the book that I think it came from was written in 2002.
Okay.
But
all right. All right.
But you'll appreciate this piece, Mac.
Okay. All right, sir. Anything that you want to get off your chest that I haven't been smart enough to ask you about?
No. I will. You know, you laid out the challenges of today, and they gave examples of when people stepped forward and did the right thing for the right reasons. You and I are aware of those, Mac, because we read history. Our youngsters today, first of all, don't read that much, and what they do read, for the most part, is not history. And this is not their fault. Our education system has shunted aside history as being irrelevant. And that, to me, that's a mortal sin in our education system, because we have to understand how we got to where we are and the mistakes that were made and the lessons that should have been learned. I mean, all of those things. So I guess what I'm doing is putting in a plug for parents who are out there to really focus on having your children read history or read history with them, which is another way to educate yourself as well as to set the example for your children. But history is, you know, the saying, if you don't read history, you're doomed to repeat it. And right. I think we're seeing more and more of that. So that's the thing I had on my chest that I had to get off.
All right. No, I learned, I read and studied because my mom That's what my mom taught me. We'd take us to the library. We'd all get books. I was a member of the Scholastic Book Club at my elementary school, St. Charles Borromeo. And when I went to my mom and I said, "Hey, Mom, is it okay if I buy these books?" And they were always World War II books, Civil War books. She said, "Yeah." And I used to get really excited when they get delivered. I have this little stack of softbound books, and I'd go and read them. And that's how I read history. But it was the encouragement of my mother. She bought me a book about the Civil War, and it had all these maps in it. And on the maps were these very detailed figures. And that's the first, my first version of Google Maps was something my mom bought me, and I was fascinated by it. I could see how the battle kind of got laid out.
Yeah.
But it was her encouragement that turned me into a reader and a student, and really gave me an inquisitive appetite for a lot of different things, not just history, but culture and food and all kinds of very neat stuff. So I think that you're remiss if you don't encourage your children to not only read, but to explore it. Get off your butt and go find the assets that you need to make yourself smart. There's no excuse for you not knowing, especially with today's day and age with the Internet at your fingertips. So you could be smart.
Our children's first teachers are their parents.
Absolutely. All right, sir. Anything exciting on the calendar for today?
I'm going to go visit, we talked about USF, the folks that run the Veterans Center there have asked me to come on by and see what they do there. So I'll go over and find out if there's anything that I can do to assist in that regard. But again, USF is very veterans friendly, and I don't say that necessarily as a plug, but it certainly is, and as well as a great school, as is St. Leo University, where I also have the privilege to teach. So that keeps me, for the most part, out of trouble and well occupied.
All right, sir. First of all, we appreciate the visit, and we'll talk to you again in a few weeks, I guess. Thank you.
Okay, Mac. Yeah, you just give me a heads up as to when and what subject, and I'll be ready to assist in any way I can.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
You bet. God bless you. Semper Fidelis.
Semper Fidelis. That is Brigadier General Tom Drowdy, United States Marine Corps retired infantry officer. First infantryman I've ever met that is ordered a bayonet charge. How about that? Who knew? Drowdy. That's some balls, sports fans. That is that. You don't need to ask if you you've got what it takes. I guess as long as it's appropriately ordered. And knowing him, it was. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you're going to hear all four parts of Ned Seath, Crossroads, coming up next on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.